do something that is different. And you look at all the heroes, and that's what they do.
The commitment to listen with the same passion with which we want to be heard.
In terms of who do you want to be, articulate that. Mm. Find the words behind that. Who do you want to be?
Welcome to another episode of the DNA of Purpose podcast. Today, I've retrieved an audio file from an interview I conducted some time ago. The essence of this interview is beautifully captured by the words of today's guest, Julie Masters, who said, "The right message at the right time, when delivered authentically, has the power to change everything." Before we get started, I want to invite you to take a moment to reflect. When was the last time a book, a movie, a song, or an inspirational speaker said something or created a moment that profoundly influenced your reality? What was it about that message that inspired you to grow? Or when was the last time you looked within and audited your own personal belief systems, the stories you tell yourself about yourself? In a world of competition and comparison, it is sometimes easy to let the voice of "I'm not enough" get in the way of our potential. It happens to the best of us. But what I do know is that those who live with purpose and who build the kind of influence required to create epic ripples of impact do so because they can hear their inner voice and have the courage to make sure that voice is empowering. The right message at the right time has the power to change everything. The point that I am making here is that words are heavy magic. They determine our ability to fulfill our purpose and to step into the transformation required to break through our upper limits. And that is essentially what Jules and I explored in today's conversation. To give you some background information on Julie, she has spent her career decoding influence. As an award-winning leading authority in the speaking world, she has earned herself a reputation for launching and advising some of the world's most respected thought leaders. She is the founder and CEO of Influence Nation, working with business leaders and organizations to become the voice of authority in their space. And she is also the host of the iTunes Top 50 podcast, Inside Influence. In today's conversation, Jules and I literally dive into the inner workings of influence, the inner beliefs and stories that determine the realization of our dreams. Jules shares incredible insights from her podcast interviews and highlights the importance of facing criticism and overcoming self-doubt, alongside emphasizing the need to develop certainty and exploring what it takes to harness mastery in a particular field in order to become a go-to expert. Ultimately, Julie believes that by rewriting our stories, owning our voice, and embracing our true potential, we all have the power to change the world. In my view, Jules has a unique ability to inspire in all of us a greater version of who we are. To ask ourselves the question, who do you think you are? And to answer from a place of empowerment. I have been lucky to have Jules in my orbit for many years, and she has certainly shared her gifts with me, and I hope that today you've received these gifts as well. Welcome to the DNA of Purpose podcast. So I'm going to kick off with my first question of the day. Now, Jules, you are the host of the Inside Influence podcast. Now, On my last check, you have interviewed 151, and I bet you've probably done more, of the world's most prominent authors, speakers, and experts on the subject of what it takes to build authority in your space, to lead a conversation, an industry, or a movement. Now, in that time, I have no doubt that you have heard about some of the most groundbreaking ideas, innovations, and trends. When you reflect on all of the interviews that you have done, and it is many, was there any one idea or even one guest that has fundamentally shifted or even disrupted your thinking with regards to the nature of influence?
You did say it was 151, right? Like,
that is correct.
There's been so many. I mean, there's been FBI hostage negotiators on what negotiation actually looks like on the front line when you when you're negotiating for the life of a human being while their families watch on. You know, very different to what universities and books teach you about negotiation. There's been magicians on, you know, how you work with perception and perspective. There's been Barack Obama, speechwriter. But I think for me, just to answer your question, it's always the last one. It's always the last one that you did. There's something magical about the podcast for me that, and we organize guests. You know, you've worked with me on the podcast before. You've been a part of it from its very inception, and you know, sometimes we book guests in 6 months in advance. Sometimes I, you know, personally invite the guests. Sometimes those guests come in via PR agencies and people that we think sound really amazing. And often, you know, I might not know who's up next week until I come to research and do the work. And so it's always really fascinating to me that whoever I talk to in the moment, it's always, without fail, exactly to relate it to something that's happening with me at that particular point.
Yes.
Always just the right message at the right
time. I was going to say, you took the words out of my mouth. I'm like, someone I know used to share these words: the right message at the right time, when delivered authentically, has the power to change everything. That quote brought to you by Julie Masters.
Well, that was when I first sat down and started my first business, the one that you came into work on with me. That was the quote that I wrote down as to why I'm doing this. This is going to be a lot of work. This is going to be a lot of hours. This is going to be a lot of my life force and energy and time and years to build. Why am I doing this? And that it was that quote that sparked it, that, you know, if I really nailed it down. And that stuck with me through all the years as the why that I do this. And it still remains true. Like the guess that it was always the right message at the right time, it's something about it. I don't know what it is. But I'm always floored by it, just absolutely floored by it. And so the one that I did last week, I'll talk to that. That was Gay Hendricks. Do you know Gay Hendricks?
Yes, I happened to listen to the episode only this morning.
Did you?
I did, yes.
And Gay Hendricks is amazing. Gay Hendricks wrote probably one of the most pivotal books that I have read on the topic of influence and stepping into your influence. And that book's called The Big Leap. And the big leap is, it's essentially the leap that you take from your zone of either competence or excellence, which is what you're good at, it's what you're known for, it's what the people come to you for, it's the thing you could do in your sleep. But there's always a calling. Usually there's a calling, and it kind of sometimes kicks in when you've been doing what you're doing for a while. And that calling is the call to our zone of genius, to do the thing that only we can do, to use the voice that only we have, to combine the experiences that only we possess, and to put that out there into the world. And so he calls that, you know, the big leap to your zone of genius and all the things that hold you back. And the biggest thing that holds us back is what he calls the upper limit problem, which is we have a limit on how influential we're prepared to be, on how seen and heard we are prepared to be, on how successful we are prepared to be, on how much we're prepared to put ourselves out there and take what comes back. And, you know, we all have versions. It's like a thermostat. You know, in the air conditioning, when you set the thermostat and as soon as it goes above that, it self-corrects. We do that. As soon as we get to a certain level, a part of us, unless we can identify and work on this upper limit problem, then our thermostat kicks in and we self-sabotage, or we take one comment, despite all the other comments that were amazing about what we're doing, we take the one comment, the one person who's having a bad day and hates their life, and we take that one and we go, I'm not doing that's it. I'm out. Oh, there's a bunch of different ways that we bring ourselves back to the level that we feel comfortable being at. But inevitably, if we don't handle the upper limit problem, we never make the big leap from our zone of competence or our zone of excellence into our zone of genius.
Mm.
And, you know, he said these words to me and they stuck with me all week. He said, most of us feel like a failed DIY project. And I was just like, oh.
Yeah, I feel that one.
Oh. Yeah. You know, most of us have this version of ourselves that we know that we are capable of being and that we want to be and the impact that we are capable or want to make. And, you know, we walk around feeling like a bit of a failed DIY project. And that really hit me, the pain and the drain of that, the drain on our energy, on our sense of self, on the impact that we're capable of having.
And there's so, I won't go into it now because we could just go so far down a rabbit hole, we wouldn't be able to come back. But the layers that exist around why we do that.
Yeah.
In terms of our social frameworks, or like I said, so many layers to that, but such fascinating comment.
Just go read the book. Like he talks about four fears. I'm going to try and get them right, Gay. I apologize if I don't. Please read the book. The fear of being fundamentally flawed, that we are fundamentally flawed in some way and we will be found out, aka imposter syndrome. The fear of outshining other people, that, you know, we believe that we don't have a right to outshine others.
Mm.
The fear of more success equals more burden. More will be expected of us and we don't know if we can give it. And I can't remember what the fourth one is now. I think it's the fear of being criticized. I think it's that one. But yeah, there's lots of reasons. It's usually set in childhood and reinforced, you know, in various different ways throughout our lives. But just this concept of the upper limit problem.
Yeah.
And how we upper limit ourselves constantly. And the people that I talk to on the podcast, to kind of circle back around to your question, the people that I talk to on the podcast, you know, they are people that have transcended that upper limit problem.
Mm. And the people
made the leap.
Yeah, the people willing to, in one hand, be the knowledgeable expert, but in the other hand, expose themselves to new information, new evidence that invites them to rethink what's possible in their own lives. Because if you stay in just, I'm the expert, you never expand your horizons. You never get uncomfortable.
And, you know, we've talked about that before, that the idea of developing and not waiting for confidence and instead developing a mindset of certainty, and the difference between confidence and certainty, you know, confidence being this magical ingredient that everyone thinks is going to show up one day, show up before we do. And the truth is that it never does, it never shows up before we show up. It's the result, it's not the ingredient. And it's the result showing up over and over and over again. And instead working on this mindset of certainty where, you know, to have a mindset of certainty just means today I'm going to give you the best that I've got. Today I'm going to give you, you know, everything that my experiences, my unique experiences and insights and my unique journey through this world has given me. And I will offer it up to you. And tomorrow, if I find out a new piece of information, if somebody gifts me a new perspective, or if the landscape changes and the rules change, you know, so will I. But today, I'm going to give you the best that I've got. And it's that owning of today, you know, not waiting for this myth of I will be perfect tomorrow. The words I say will be perfect tomorrow. I will be experienced enough tomorrow. I will not be, you know, too young, too old, two, whatever our twos are, we have so many twos. I'm going to wait until they're gone.
And, then. And I mean, I think the truth for me anyway, in my experience of speaking or even hosting a podcast, is that I always get nervous. That part doesn't go away in any capacity, but I have got a lot better at being nervous and channeling it. I think essentially that's a part of what certainty is.
Mm-hmm. And I think you put it beautifully in a conversation that we had recently, which is learning to feel the fear without being paralyzed. You know, there's a difference between fear and paralysis. And I know because I've done both. Sorry, I know that there is a difference. And, you know, we've all heard the term feel the fear, do it anyway. It's not that. It's just learning to recognize that there is a part of us, there is a part of our brain, there is a part of our wiring that will always shy away from something that feels very exposing, something that feels like lots of eyes are on us. There are lots of, there are some people who run towards it, absolutely. But for you and for me and for many other people out there, you know, we're not those people. And I will walk towards it consciously and feeling the part of me that's, you know, that's wanting to withdraw and channel enough certainty in what I have to say and what I have to give to move me forwards. But that voice just never goes. That voice never goes back. It never does. And it's got to the point now where I can actually, I can schedule it. So exactly 24 hours before I'm due to do anything big, it might be a big presentation, it might be a big interview, this voice will kick in. My mind will go blank. I'll forget anything that I wanted to say. And this voice will kick in and it will go, oh, no, 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 we need to count the whole thing right now. Like, seriously.
I'm out.
Like, this is going to be the end of us, you and me. And we should can it. Just forget it. Let's go have a margarita and forget we ever had this dumbass idea.
Yeah. I'm not doing the upper limit. That ain't happening.
I'm not upper limit. I don't want to. I like my limits. I like them. And the in... And I know when it kicks in now, and I know it's always the day before. And what I have been able to do is develop a response to that voice, which is as compassionately as I can, you know what, we're not going to cancel it. We never cancel it. You ask every time and we never do. So we're never going to cancel it. We're not going to cancel it this time. And every single time we do it, it's just fine. In fact, sometimes it's amazing and sometimes it's great and sometimes it's just fine. But we're always all right.
And you show up.
And we show up. We always show up. That's exactly it. We always show up. So, you know, how about we just do what we do every time, which is, you know, dig back in and go show up. And it gets easier. It gets easier. It's like a muscle. Again, you and I have talked about this gym, like, having a certainty gym where it's a muscle and you keep doing it over and over and over again.
Yeah, and you get better at it in the process just as you get stronger at the gym.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. The other thing that you said, which I thought was amazing when we talked last, was you said that there's – I asked you what your keys were to elevating to the level of influence that you have reached. And – you said that you have learned how to face criticism.
Yeah, it's funny. I had a question about that and I took it out because I'm like, don't make the interview all about
No, because I think it's really worthy.
Well, thank you. I'm honoured that you would bring that up because it well, you go on to share what we were talking about because it's an interesting topic.
It just stuck with me. It stuck with me that you said it because that is the growth piece, right? That is the leap. It's the, I am not, you know, I am certainly not amazing. I'm going to start out not, you know, not my best version. And I have this thing, it's always version eight. I'm going to start out with version one. I'm just going to accept the fact that if it doesn't suck, that's a win. Or if it only sucks marginally. And, you know, for every version, it's going to get better and better and better. And version eight might be something that I don't want to, you know, crawl in a box if I show anybody. But in order to move through those versions, you need to take feedback and you need to take negative feedback. And to be able to take it and not freeze or withdraw or remove permission from yourself to keep going, that's the key. And I am curious as to how you did that, how you made that flip. Sorry, now I'm interviewing you.
Well, for a start, I had to accept that if I wanted to play at this level where we're getting paid significant amounts of money to stand on somebody's stage for 1 hour, to have that privilege, then it was also my responsibility to be radically honest about the product they were buying. And I guess in a sense I made it less about me and more about the person I was serving, because they've invested in the speaking version of a Gucci handbag. So it is my responsibility to do everything that I can to ensure that every stitch is perfect, every detail is perfect on that bag. And if there's something wrong with that bag, I either need to be able to see that for myself, or I need to accept and adapt should somebody else see that on that handbag, because otherwise that handbag is no longer worth that amount of money. And so I think I, in a sense, not that I was conscious of it, but I removed it from being about me and started to view myself in that context as a very privileged person, a lucky person who had a certain set of tools to have the opportunity to stand on a stage, but that to play at the level for which I was expected to be playing at, then it's no longer about me. It's about delivering at that level.
And I like that separation piece. And I think that kicks in even before, you know, there's the being worthy of what has been asked of you and what has been given to you as an opportunity. There's that piece. I think there's also a phase before that, which for me, and again, like a broken record with this bit, but I've always been fascinated with, you know, what does world-class look like? You know, what does world-class look like? Again, it's not about me or whether you like me or you enjoy what I have to say, but what does world-class look like? Like, what does a world-class presenter look like? What does a world-class podcast sound like? And just getting really deeply curious and forensic about that question. And then going, what's my version of that?
Yeah, and I'd add a level to what you're talking about there. If you are somebody who's wanting to lean into influence and go to the next level, is what does world-class feel like?
Yes.
Because when you're on stage, you know the difference. You know where you're playing and where you need to be. And when you get it right, you feel it. You feel world-class.
Yeah.
Mm.
Because the energy shifts.
Yeah.
And it's hard to put your finger on what that is. I think it stops being about you and what's going on in your head and how you're feeling. And in the world of neurolinguistic programming, you know, you've got first position, which is, if I'm in first position, all I'm doing is listening to the monologue, constant monologue in my own head. And I'm just wondering how I'm feeling, what's going on for me, what's happening in my body. And then to move from first position to second position, which is where you start thinking about other people. How are they feeling? What's going on for them? What do they need right now? But the danger of second position is that then if you look at somebody in the audience who is potentially having a bad day or is really enjoying it but just hasn't told their face, or, you know, has fallen asleep, as has happened, you would be amazed. Speak to some of the best speakers in the world. They can all tell a story of looking at the audience and seeing someone that has fallen asleep.
I had my first 3 weeks ago.
Did you?
Because you'd said that to me, I was like, it's okay. It's happened before. It's not just me.
Yeah. And, you know, if you're in second position, that will destroy you.
Yeah.
Because now you're just focused, you're zoning in on one human being and what's happening for that human being, not that you could ever possibly know. But the idea, you know, in terms of what world class looks and feels like, the idea is that you move into third position, where you're in your body enough to be owning the room, but you're also paying attention to the room as a whole. What does this room need? What does this collection of human beings need right now? Do they need to move? Do they need to talk? Do they need to think? Do they need to laugh? Do they need to? And you're adjusting in the moment. And that takes time and that takes practice and that takes mastering. But that's, you know, the level that you're moving towards. And I also, I remember a speaker saying to me once way, way, way back in the day, it was probably about 15 years ago, and I said something, you know, that's when it will be good enough. And he said, what's good enough? Mm. What is good enough? He said, it's such a funny phrase. What's good enough look like? And I loved the question because I thought, I really just really need an answer to that, actually. And I came up with the answer that good, when you know you are good enough, when you are match fit enough, when you have put in enough prep, enough work, enough received enough feedback, is when every single thing that you put out there creates two or three more opportunities.
Mm.
Every single time you show up, it creates two or three more opportunities to show up, either at the same level or a different level.
Mm. When what you've created becomes sticky.
Yeah, and it has a ripple effect to it. Mm. That's when you know. That's when you know that you've reached that point where, you know, you can dial back a little bit now on the mastery of the craft, and you can, you know, you can start to enjoy the process and the journey and seeing where it takes you. But again, this is all tied to getting match fit, getting and staying match fit.
Mm. So, Jules, I've obviously been thinking about you quite a lot in preparation of today's podcast, and just, I guess, reflecting on some of your journey that I have had the privilege of witnessing. And one of the questions that came to mind was, why influence? And to give that a little bit of context, anyone who knows you knows that you are just world-class at anything that you put your mind to. And I think you could have chosen any area of thought leadership at the beginning. If you'd chosen to become a master in leadership and only leadership, you could have gone down that pathway. You could have chosen resilience, high performance. And I think had you been passionate about any of those subjects, you would probably be in the same position you are today with influence. But you chose influence. So what is it about the world of business influence that made you willing to show up in a way where literally all of your waking work hours have been committed to decoding, to translating, to sharing with the world insights about this one particular topic?
Oh, for me, that goes back a long way. I was always really fascinated with movement. Mm-hmm. With, you know, it was part of why, you know, we created Ode, which was the talent management agency for speakers and authors. And I was always really fascinated with what made an idea move, you know, what made a human being compelling. And what kind of ideas get traction, and why do they get traction, and why do they stop or stall, and why do some go on to create entire global movements, and what does it take to hold that as a human being, not only spark it into the world, but hold it all the way through to a desired outcome. And, you know, I used to read books on Nazi Germany, on Hitler's, the time of Hitler, and be like, there's something in here, you know. Mm. There's a code in here somewhere of how you take an idea, embed it, and then turn it into mass scale action, that if the people with the good ideas, the healthy ideas, the amazing ideas have access to that, then, you know, we would start to see a birth of so many amazing things. Mm. Across the planet. You know, if people who worked in the field of climate change had access to that, if, you know, people who worked in fields of incredible science, or people who have ideas that are going to lift entire industries or change the course of conversations, you know, if they had access to that knowledge. And that just makes me really curious. It just makes me really curious. What is it? What makes a human being stand out? What makes an idea compelling? And what is it about the alchemy of those two things that has the power to change everything, has the power to start and stop a revolution, you know, start and stop a global movement? So that just makes me very, 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 very curious, and that has kept me busy for a very long time, because I think that often people with the best ideas and the best intentions get left on the sidelines because they don't necessarily have the tools or know what to do with their brilliance. And all too often the people with the ideas that, that say aren't so healthy for society at large have figured out what to do. And I want to see a world where the best ideas and the best intentions and the best human beings rise, rise to the top, and can actually create change.
So that's, I was going to say, that's a beautiful segue to the next part of the conversation. You've probably heard us share the Future Crunch quote, that if we want to change the story of the human race in the 21st century, then we need to change the stories that we tell ourselves. And so in looking at this process that you speak of, this this toolkit essentially that people can potentially use to be able to ignite positive movements in the world, more often than not, it is the story that we tell ourselves that is the starting point. And that might be in reflection of how we perceive the world and whether we feel hopeful or you know, cynical about the future. But more specifically, I think it can also include the stories that we tell ourselves, and maybe that is one of the most significant tools as we start this influence journey that you're talking about. Can you share with me your perception of the power of the stories we tell ourselves?
It all starts there. It all starts there. Every single decision that we make, every single time we push past what we believe we can or can't do, every time we decide to or decide not to use our voice, it starts and stops with the voice inside our head, with the stories inside our head. There's this beautiful word in Spanish, and you know what I'm going to say, called duende, and it's a word that doesn't have any direct translation into English. But the best that I have been able to find is that they talk about it as if it's almost like a woodland fairy. That the kind of this magical creature. And where you see duende come into play in Spanish culture is if you go to a flamenco. Now, I'm obsessed with flamenco dancers, with flamenco. Because there is something about a flamenco dancer, like if you watch them take to the stage, the way they hold themselves, the gravity with which they move, they are so compelling. Like you just... they come on the stage, everything goes quiet. You can't take your eyes off them. Like there is a presence and a gravity to their motions and movement and a way that they tune themselves in. And the Spanish will kind of sit in that silence and watch the flamenco dancer, and the flamenco dancer won't move for a while. They'll stand perfectly still. And the Spanish will kind of watch, and then eventually, you know, someone will say, oh, did you see? The duende just arrived. And the duende is that thing that makes us absolutely captivating, absolutely compelling, at our most powerful.
It's when the pin drops in the room.
Yeah, and you can feel it when it shows up. But the other part of that legend is that in order for the duende to arrive, something has to die, and it's usually a story. It's usually a story that we have about our right to be there, our own worth, our own expertise, experience, abilities. And it's only when we let that story die that the duende arrives, that there is space for it to arrive. And I think for most of us, that story starts with the question, you know, who do you think you are? This fear that we have around this question, who do you think we are? Who do you think you are? Most of us fear it.
It comes back to the upper limit again.
Yeah. who we fear someone like, who do you think you are? Who do you think you are to get up there and claim to be an expert? Mm. Who do you think you are to say yes, to say no? Who do you think you are to have a perspective, an opinion, a voice, to disagree with me? I've been doing it much longer. And we live in fear of this question. And we also live in fear of asking it of ourselves. Oh my goodness, who do I think I am to do this? And this one little question keeps more people small than any other question that I know. And often it's the story that we need to let die as the answer to our question. Who do I think I am? I'm just, you know what, I've not been doing this long. I don't have enough expertise. I've got, you know, tons of research and information here, but, you know, what does that mean? It doesn't stack up against the people who've been doing it much longer than me. You know, it's how we answer that question in the moment.
Can I ask you, when you've gone through this process, have you found that you've needed to heal parts of yourself? Because I'm just going through that process myself. I'm thinking, who do I think I am? I've landed on a story that keeps me small. Then what?
Yeah. Then you replace it. Then you replace it. And firstly, you need to know it exists. There's job number one. A lot of times we tell ourselves our stories, and when we start digging, we're like, oh my God, really? That's there? That's still there? You know, that fear of outshining, that fear, that feeling of being fundamentally flawed, that, you know, the fear of a burden, of being a burden, or of taking on more burden. And so firstly, I think we need to look at it and actually dig it out. Like, what is that story? And when we can figure out what it is, then it's our job to replace it with a better one. Because usually that story was written for us. And now it's our job to pick up the pen and write our own. And the story that we choose in that moment needs to be compelling enough that when somebody asks the question, and they will, it's going to happen. You know, when someone asks the question, who do you think you are? Who do you think you are to do this? Who do you think you are to stand up? Rather than derailing us and going, you're right, I don't know. I don't know who I think I am. Or, oh my goodness, I do, and that's... it's not good. As soon as someone asks the question, if we have rewritten an answer that serves us, an answer that propels us, that elevates us and drives us, then it's a reminder as to who we really are. You know, it's, who do I think I am? Well, you know, guess what? I think I'm the CEO of Influence Nation. Like, I have a top 50 podcast globally. I have 20 years of experience in my space. And quite frankly, I have information that I think is useful and will help a lot of people do amazing things. So, you know what? That's who I think I am. You know, you find...
It's like your power story emerges underneath it.
You find your own, write your own. But first you've got to look at the one that exists and pick a better one.
And so from there, something I've observed in you is you're someone who, at least from the outside, I've watched you set intentions to change something. It could be change a pattern, change a behavior, up-level yourself. And you seem to step really gracefully into the congruent action to make that change real. And you make it look quite easy. Now, I'm sure that it is not easy in any way.
Oh, if Josh were here now, he would be cracking up.
But, you know, I highlight this because we've got step one, which is changing the story. Mm-hmm. However, if the story on its own was enough, there would be a lot more people reaching their upper limit. The story needs to be followed by congruent action. Mm-hmm. How have you gone about being disciplined in that process?
Firstly, I don't think that I do it gracefully. I honestly don't. I just think that I've got a lot more comfortable with the messy of it. And by the time anyone notices, I've developed some form of grace with it. But I've got a lot better with the messy. I try to get very conscious about what I want to change or what I want to bring in. And then I study it. You know, if there's a certain thing that I want to develop more of in my life, I will, you know, I get up, practical things. I get up not super early. I get up at 6:15. The kids get up anytime between 6:30 and 7. And I do 15 minutes of reading. And I might read the same book, no joke. I might read the same book over and over again for 6 months because I just haven't integrated it yet. It's not in my bones yet. You know, I'm not ready to move on yet. I haven't got this yet. And then I go for a walk. So those are two things I usually do in the morning. I read 15 minutes, which I could say I have this beautiful morning miracle where I spend an hour. I don't. I have two young children.
But I do go
for a walk in the mornings.
Yeah, little rituals.
Pardon?
I just said little rituals.
Yeah, mine are much smaller. But when I go for a walk, and I was talking about this with Mark Shulman recently, he's the Pink's drummer or was Pink's drummer. He's recently off doing an amazing TV show in the States. And we were talking about the power of embodying. And so often I will walk, and while I am walking, I will think about who I want to be, how I want to show up, what I want to create. How does someone walk that does that? How does someone hold themselves? What would they do right now? Would they, you know, send a text to a friend to say thank you for being amazing? Would they, what would they do? And I literally practice embodying that thing. And, you know, there's a school of thought there, which is, you know, the fake it until you make it. And there's also Amy Cuddy's fake it until you become it. And I'm definitely a fan of that school of thought. You know, I'm faking it until I become it. I have decided. Mm-hmm. And it's messy and unreliable. Until one day you are just being that thing a lot more regularly than you were before. So, yeah, I think that's probably the answer to the question. Mm. And it takes a long time, you know. I know maybe on the outside it looks like I decide and then it suddenly happens, but trust me, there are things I am still working on that I decided I wanted to bring more of into my life 2 years ago. And every day I'm like, still haven't got that one, obviously.
I love how grounded your answer is. Because you take a realistic approach, because I mean the reality is that, you know, we can see someone we want to be like or have a level of influence that we want to reach, but bringing that into the world into our world in a real way is more about those tiny moments of magic.
Yeah, and you know we've said before we talked about alter egos again, amazing book, check it out. This concept of having an alter ego, which isn't a fake version of you, but it's when you identify, and I have my alter egos up in my shower. Anybody, you know, literally laminate. I bought a laminator and they're laminated and they're up in my shower and they change. They change frequently. Well, not frequently, probably once every 6 months, once every 12 months, but people who have qualities that I'm trying to bring in to myself. And, you know, having three or four people where you're like, I love the way they do that. I love how they've created this. I love how they navigate this. I love how they hold themselves here. And you use this beautiful phrase. What was it? Remix and
what did I call it?
It was
like
amazing.
It was something like, yeah, it was replicate and remix.
Replicate and remix. Exactly.
Yeah.
So you're not trying to be that person. You're just replicating and remixing, taking something that you see that you admire, using it as a breadcrumb and going, okay, what's my version?
Mm.
What's my version of that?
They're not always people that need to be on the front of Forbes magazine. I know that you have been someone who I have absolutely replicated and remixed in many forms over the last 20 years. And sometimes those people are close mentors or colleagues. They don't need to be like Oprah Winfrey, although they can be. But sometimes they're the people who you can actually spend quality time with and time observing the nuances of what they do. And that's certainly been something that's led me forward on my journey.
Oh, yeah. I mean, half the people who are up on my show wall are not people that you would know.
Mm.
They're people who I have come across or some people I have worked with. It doesn't matter whether anybody else knows who they are or not.
Mm.
What matters is there's something in there. They have tuned into something that you want to start tuning yourself into. Because, you know, we work at different frequencies. And, you know, when you can go, right, that's it. And then you just start to slowly tune yourself in. Okay, yep, I can feel it now. But, yeah, it takes intention. I think that's probably the two things.
Mm-hmm. One aspect, I imagine most of those people on your shower wall would have, is your trust to some degree. And I think trust is probably one of the most significant aspects of what it is to be able to build and maintain a level of influence. So I'm interested to, I guess, get your perspective on trust. I mean, there's so many areas we could explore from how we gain it to maintain it to what loses it and how do we get it back if we've lost it. What do you think is the most important thing to know about trust in the game of influence?
I think we trust lives at the level of intention. We believe often that trust lives at the level of action, and actually trust lives at the level of intention. And your actions need to back up your intention more often than not. But often when we don't trust somebody, it's because we're not really sure about their intention. We're not really clear on their intentions, or we are clear and we don't like their intention. Like not sure I like where he's coming from, where she's coming from. And therefore we view every action through that lens. Everything that they do comes with this story about the fact that we're not 100% on their intentions. And the opposite applies, right? Like you have someone where you're really clear on their intention. It feels very true to you, their intention. And then they can get 50% of stuff wrong. And you'll be like, do you know what? I know where they're coming from though. And I trust that they're going to keep moving and keep improving. Now, it's not having a good intention is not an excuse to continually not deliver. But what I'm saying is that a lot of time we don't say our intent. We don't talk about our intentions because it's a vulnerable thing to do, right? To say, you know, my intention here is this. My intention for this company is this. My intention for this conversation is this. My intention for you is this. And I have found that stating your intention, getting clear on it, stating your intention is one of the most powerful roads to trust. Because again, if someone can buy into your intention, there's leeway with your actions. You're not going to get it right every time. But if you get one thing wrong, it's not going to bring the whole house down. So I think for me, it starts at the level of intent. Francis Fraser done some amazing work on trust.
She has an amazing TED Talk.
Has an amazing work. So then check it out, Francis Fray. Her work is amazing. And she talks about, you know, you need to have the logic. You need to be able to communicate in a compelling way. And again, I can't remember the third pillar that she has there. But underpinning that, for me, is intention, to be clear on and to communicate your intention.
And so I'm curious to know then, how is trust a baseline for what comes next in the game of influence? Again, I'll give you a little bit of context to answer that question. But let's say, you know, I'm a leader. So we've already discussed the first bucket of influence, which is how we influence ourselves. Let's go to the next bucket, which is I'm a leader, I've got a team, I have a new mindset I want to implement, or I need to translate a new pathway of work to get to this point of innovation, whatever it is. How do we then take this baseline of trust and then use that to be able to influence change in a team or in a community?
So you're saying that if you already have people's trust, how do you move them?
How do you move forward? How do you then get people to, I guess, buy in and to adapt to whatever it is you're putting forward?
I think a big part of influence is what we call decoding the road, decoding the road forward. And that, you know, if I had to put influence into, you know, its most simple of terms, you know, it is our job to make the complex simple. It is our job to decode the road forward and explain it in such a way that it seems manageable.
I love that. Decode the road forward. That's great.
Yeah, that's our biggest job, to become the translator, to translate complexity into simplicity. That is our biggest job as influencers. Those are the people that we follow. Those are the people we buy from. Those are the people we buy into. And those are the people who create long-term change. It's not just, you know, a big noise, do this thing. You know, we've all done that. Sign this petition, do this thing. Show up to this meeting and, you know, we all go and there's no real clear path forward from there. You know, someone who has, I'm really obsessed with this term at the moment of trailblazers, the trailblazers. And what the trailblazers used to do in Australia and also in the US is that they would head into the wilderness and they would blaze a trail for everybody else. They would carve a trail. And they would leave markers along the way for everybody else to say, I have traveled this road. I'm decoding it for you. Follow my markers. Now, you only ever had to be two or three markers ahead of everybody else. But it was their job to carve a path forward and to make it as easy to navigate as possible. And I think that that's what this world needs. It's more trailblazers. It's more people who have headed out into the wilderness and carved a path forward. It's not people who are, you know, let me tell you all the theory. You know, let me give you some more carefully crafted words. It's people who are out there who have done it and who come back and say, look, I've done it. I've left markers for you. I've decoded the road forward. And here are the pitfalls. Here's what we're going to face. But do you know what? I've managed it. We can do this. I know how to step past that. So I think it's the trailblazers, the people who have the ability to take something that's overwhelming and feels just like the wild, wild west, and which is the world right now and the overwhelming, and decode that word for us.
I love how much you've simplified it in terms of decoding the road. But honestly, I feel like if our listeners only took that tool and implemented it, they would create significant change with regards to how they influence others immediately.
Well, I got asked into a company recently who, you know, it's a travel company.
Yeah.
And we're coming out of a significantly bad time for travel and travel organizations. And it was a group of leaders and they were just saying, you know, we don't know how to lead them through what's coming next because we don't know what's coming next. And we're a bit stuck as to how to influence our teams. And it was exactly that. It was, okay, well, you know, you don't need to know what the final destination is going to be. You don't need to know what the environment's going to do. Your job is to decode the road forward, as simple a path as you can, so that everybody can get on the bus and stay on the bus. And who believes, you know, you're not saying I know everything, but you're saying that we know enough. We've been here. We've been through hard times before. You know what? We know it takes this and then this and then this. We'll just stick to this, stick to the path. It's that kind of clarity and that kind of conviction and certainty and simplicity that makes somebody very influential. And that will bypass all the information in the world.
Yeah.
You know? And that I think we'll get more ROI.
Yeah. The ability to do that in a way where other people can take that code and make it their own. So it's not just decoding the road through your lens, it's decoding the road. So if I, for example, haven't been attacked by a lion, I can still use that blueprint, that map, those learning keys, those stepping stones, whatever you want to call it, to apply that to my world, and it's still going to make sense.
Well, because, I mean, let's just take that for a second. You know, you and I are well used to working in metaphors with speakers, yes, in the speaking world. And, you know, to talk about being attacked by a lion, you know, you're not really talking about being attacked by a lion there. I mean, the chances of that very specific thing happening to somebody else, very slim. But you can talk about setbacks, and you can talk about fear, and you can talk about resilience, and you can talk about dealing with the unknown, and you can talk about being prepared, and you can talk about, you know, our ability to stay flexible and keep a keen radar, you know, the markers to look for. Like, there's so much. It doesn't have to be, you know, this is exactly what's going to happen to you. It isn't that. It's here is the road forward. There are going to be pitfalls. There are going to be curveballs. There are going to be things that are going to happen that we're not going to see coming. But if we stick to the road, and deal with them as they come up and manage our fear and manage our energy and manage our resilience, then we can make it to the end. I know this. You know, then it doesn't become about being attacked by a lion, because they might be attacked by a raccoon or, you know, a crocodile. It's about giving them a roadmap and then the tools and the belief that they can get to the other side.
So, Jules, we've just referenced not knowing what's going to happen tomorrow in various phrases at points in the conversation. However, in the game of influence, one of the things that we cannot do is stand still for too long, because we need to be able to translate from the cutting edge of, you know, what's about to change or to evolve in our area of influence, whatever that is. So I'm curious to know, how do you personally go about ensuring that, on one hand, you know, you're the knowledgeable expert, which is, we spoke about this at the beginning, you're the knowledgeable expert and you're across business as usual and you're able to translate that, while at the same time having your eyes tuned for that next disruption, the unprecedented change, the what could be?
You keep a radar. I think you, ironically, you find your own translators. You find the people who translate different worlds for you. I mean, I keep a very close eye on Google's Unskippable Labs, for example, because they translate a lot of digital storytelling for me and what's working in digital storytelling, because they have access to more storytelling data than any team on the planet. So I keep a close eye on them. There's certain trend websites that I subscribe to. There's certain people that I pay close attention to. So I have my translators kind of set up. And so I'm always watching to see what the new developments are. And I think that there's also a lot to be said for holding a line and not getting distracted by everything shifting. You know,
that's true.
Taking the information that can inform and help you be better at what you do, and also help the people that you serve to be better. You know, here's some trends that are coming up that are useful for you to know, but not get lost in the noise. There's so much noise. And so trying not to get overwhelmed. Pick some key translators, the ones who you respect the most in your field, and follow them. And get those insights regularly and just to try and tune out the rest, because otherwise you can just drown.
Your influence information diet.
Yes, exactly, exactly. Yes. And Peter Crunch and you talk a lot about that.
We do. Very
conscious and clear about who you consume, who and what you consume.
Yeah.
Keeping a healthy diet there.
Yeah. And I think it is really important, because we are seeing more and more people stepping out there into influence, and that is amazing. But for the purpose of your influence, just getting clear on who's going to add the most value, because again, you can go down that rabbit hole and you will never come back. So
you can overeat.
You can overeat, definitely.
And all you will get is digestion.
Yeah. Hey, Jules, I'm going to end the podcast today with something that I call the Fast Five. And I'm a bit excited about this. I'm excited about asking you these questions. So, quick and short answers. You can take a second to pause and think if you need to. Some of these questions have a slight curveball factor.
Okay.
Let's start with question one. You can choose one person outside of your field of expertise or industry to learn from. Who are they and why do you choose them?
Outside of my field.
Outside of your field of expertise.
I'm going to pick Benjamin Zander. He's the conductor of the Boston Philharmonic.
I was going to say that name rings a bell. Yeah, now I know why.
Amazing to talk. He's an amazing human being. And I would just love, there is something about watching people communicate, watching speakers on the stage, that always feels like music to me. That there's a cadence to it. You know, I'm listening to it and I can feel the energy of the words. I can feel the speed of the words. I can feel the pauses between. You can feel when the audience moves forwards and moves back. It feels like cadence. It feels like rhythm. And I would love to learn or talk, you know, find out about conducting an orchestra and see what that feels similar. You know, you have all these people who are all experts in their own field who need to come together and play something harmoniously, and you need to like read them all at the same time and get them aligned. I think that would just be fascinating to find out how much of it is logical and how much of it is just your body moving.
Yeah, just tuning in.
Just tuning in, yeah. I think that
I'm dancing here for given people can't see me.
There was a lot of hand motion going on there. Yeah, I'd love to learn how to conduct.
Okay, my next question. I can't wait to get this answer. Which fictional family would you be a member of?
Fictional
family. Simpsons, Flintstones.
Oh, definitely not Yellowstone. I'm just putting that out there.
No.
That's a no. Fictional family. I'm trying to think of some.
Or non-fictional family.
No, fictional family. This is a random, but Offspring. It's an Australian drama. And that family, I just loved. They were just messy and united and beautiful and human. And yeah, that. Or I just watched Bad Sisters.
Okay. I haven't seen that. I have to check it out.
Amazing. Yeah. It came as a recommendation from someone that both you and I know. Amazing show. It's about these five sisters. I'd definitely be a sixth sister to those five.
You're in. When did you last change your mind about a subject? What was your opinion and how did it evolve?
I think I changed my mind about my ability to make up my mind, if that makes sense.
Mm.
You know, over the past couple of years, I started to notice that my opinions, the world was just agreeing with me.
Yeah.
You know, the media sources I was choosing were agreeing with me. The people I was tuning into were agreeing with me. And it's always very suspicious when that happens. And I started to question my beliefs and whether or not they were just, I was just perpetuating things
that were being fed
to information that disagrees with me and only inviting in information that agrees with me. So I changed my mind on a few things with that. I started, you know, I'm very left field in my politics, and I started tuning out of left field channels and I started tuning into right wing channels. And I changed my mind about a few things. I can't remember anything specific, but a few different pieces in that where I potentially didn't have all the information, or there was a perspective there that, although maybe I didn't agree with, it rounded out a belief that I held and gave it a new flavor. And so I think I've been slowly changing my mind on a few things. But I have to say, I had this conversation with a friend over the weekend. I feel like the first 25 years of our life is spent getting certain about a lot of things and making up my mind. Excellent. Now I'm going to make up my mind about something else. I'm going to make up my mind about all the things and then I'm done because I have my mind clearly made up on all the things that matter. And then I feel like the next 25 years of your life is just life slowly introducing gray areas and context and all the niggly bits that make it hard to be certain about something. You know, when you say, I would never do that, that's wrong. And then you have periods of your life where you or you, someone you love where there are a set of circumstances where you think, I completely understand why I did that, given the circumstances. So I feel like first 25 years of my life was spent making up my mind, and the next 25 years will probably be breaking my mind, adding in some gray area, and remaking my mind to the point where I have an opinion, but at the end of the opinion it's like, but what would I know?
I love that. What book is on your bedside table?
Oh, I am rereading Gay Hendricks, The Big Leap.
I need to get this book. That is soon going to be on my bedside table too. Now, the last question for the day. If you had a billboard in Times Square that was yours for one day, one week, what would it say?
Your voice can change everything. I think we underestimate the power of our voice. In conversations, in relationships, in our careers, in our ability to have the impact that we want to have. And a lot of times we let people speak for us or we repeat what we think people want us to say. And I think when you find your voice, you know, it can change, it changes everything. So yeah, I think it would be that and someone said to me recently, you are always only a 10-minute sweaty conversation away from the relationships of your dreams. I love that. You know, most issues can be solved by a sweaty 10-minute conversation that you do not want to have. So one of those two, both around using your voice, strangely enough.
Yeah, I love it. Your voice can change everything. You have just given me my official 1-minute social media reel in that last question because, gosh, just sitting with that, it's such a simple thing and such a profound and profoundly beautiful thing at the same time. And what a gift it has been to have your voice changing everything on this podcast today, Jules. It is such a joy to have had you as a guest.